for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 262 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast, the first of 2017. Thanks so much for listening. This week I have a great interview with Michael Manomivable, a wonderful artist and sequential creator who makes all kinds of terrific art and has comics coming in his future, one of the things he wants to accomplish. He talks about other things that he's taken on as a challenge and things that we can keep up with him as he moves into this new year. We talk about conventions, we talk about his social media and his recent Kickstarter campaign, and he's got a lot of interesting things to say in a great funny interview to start off this new year. There's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast Michael Manomivable, an illustrator, and he does individual artwork and sequential art, not to mention all kinds of interesting things. How are you doing today, Michael?
I'm doing good.
I thought we'd start off by me reading from your very own website about who you are, which is kind of fun to do. You say, Michael is a freelance illustrator whose work thrives on mystery and atmosphere. He's been known to work on books about spooky beings and grand adventure. Born in Boston, raised in Bangkok, Michael has a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Illustration from the California College of the Arts. Michael currently resides in Oakland, California, and you list a bunch of clients that you've had. And, of course, there's two of them that stand out to me. I mean, well, they all stand out, really, but the ones that I think that I want to ask about is IDW, of course, IDW Comics. Of course, this being a comic-related podcast, I want to get to your sequential art, too. But talk to me about IDW and what you've done for IDW.
IDW was actually some of my very first ever professional work. I haven't done a lot of comic work, and that's definitely something I'd like to pursue as my career goes on a little bit more. But I was exhibiting at APE in San Francisco, the Alternative Press Expo, when this random guy walked by and said, "Oh, wow, seems like you would be interested in cover work." And I said, "Yeah, for sure." You know, this was, oh man, this must have been in like 2010 or 11.
Wow.
Watch, I like forget like when I do stuff now. and he told me he was an editor at IDW and he gave me his contact info. And we talked back and forth for a while. And he said at the time, like, he was like, "Yeah, you know, I don't really have work for you right now, but I know you're looking for, you know, experience doing it too. Mm-hmm. And I'm working on a book and, you know, here's the script if you want to do like just pieces for your portfolio." And, you know, at the time I was just like, "Yeah, okay. I honestly don't have a lot else going on." So I just did my own cover take on it. And they liked it so much that he convinced his higher ups to run it as a retailer incentive cover.
Cool.
That's how I went. That book, that first book was called That Hellbound Train, which is a comics adaptation of a Robert Bloch, I believe.
Oh, really?
Old horror writer, Robert Bloch story from a while back. Mm-hmm. That was a 3-issue miniseries, and I did the alternative covers for all of those. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, it just kind of went on from there. I did another miniseries with the same editor, and this was one of his first writing projects, if not his first writing project. Mm-hmm. And that was called Night of a Thousand Wolves. Mm. And did all 3 alternative cover runs for that, too.
Mm, cool. Wow. So do you keep doing things for IDW these days, or have they kind of...
I went on to do a few more pieces for them. They actually, for a little while, were trying to get off the ground a series, I think a new like publishing arm or a new imprint that was focused more on literature. Mm-hmm. So I did a series of 3 books for them called, I'm going to just call them the In the Shadow Of series. So the first book was called In the Shadow Of Dracula. And they were all stories, classic vampire stories, either that inspired Dracula or were inspired by Dracula. So it was pretty cool. Like, as a literary thing, it was really neat to read the story that inspired Nosferatu. Hmm. Or the stories that supposedly inspired Bram Stoker's Dracula. Hmm. So cool. I did that, and then I did another book called In the Shadow of Sherlock Holmes, which is the same exact idea, but stories that inspired or were inspired by Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes.
Wow.
The last one in that series was In the Shadow of Poe, which was my favorite one. And by then, I was actually quite pleased with that work and loved those stories the most. In the Shadow of Poe actually had, like, the monkey's paw in it. Mm-hmm. If you're a Simpsons fan, mm-hmm. there's a Treehouse of Horror mm-hmm. episode based on the monkey's paw.
Cool. So, well, it keeps you busy with those kinds of things. Now, another one I've noticed you've done is one of my companies that I really like because they do all kinds of interesting storytelling, and that's Scholastic. Scholastic does one of my favorite books out, which comes out occasionally, is Amulet.
Yes.
So I'm just curious, which ones have you been doing for Scholastic?
So I only did one interior piece for Scholastic. It was for a story about Chupacabra. Mm. But I honestly, that was, I think that was 2012. Mm-hmm. It's a little while ago now. I honestly forget the title of the book. Mm-hmm. But that was just one interior piece. I constantly try to keep in contact with them because I also love their sequential work that they're putting out. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine, Greg Ruth, works with them a lot on his comics. Mm-hmm. He just released a book with Ethan Hawke, the actor / comic book writer now. I think it's about the Native American, like, war in the West. Honestly, I haven't had time to read it yet, but I
have to look for that because I love their Amulet. And Scholastic also put out the colored versions of Bone by Jeff Smith, which I really like.
Yes.
So yeah. They do some good stuff. I really like it. And so I'm always fascinated. If I remember correctly, wasn't Scholastic the one that J.K. Rowling got to hire for the Harry Potter books in the beginning?
I actually visited the offices once, and the whole lobby is like, it was at the time, Harry Potter, super Harry Potter'd out.
Now, of course, I always like to, when I talk to an artist, I can't really display art over an audio podcast, but if you go to Mike's website, it's Mike Mano Art, MikeManoArt.com, and you can look through his illustrations there. Are there other sites that you show your illustrations onto that people can look at if they want to look something besides that?
Yeah, I'm on pretty much all the social medias. You can find me at Mike Mano Art on Instagram, Tumblr, Facebook, Twitter, whichever platform you prefer to hook your feet up into. Yeah, Mike Mano Art.
Which, of course, a play on your last name, which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. I like that. Before I jump into your illustration, I want to talk a little bit. There's a sequential story on your website called Made to Be Together. And instead of TOs, you've got the number 2 in there. And it's a story about, and it's only about 7 pages long, about 2 robots, which is kind of interesting. And what's really interesting to me is how you use certain panels over again. On page 2 and on page 3, up in the upper left-hand corner, there's a man with his hand on his chin, and there's a dollar sign next to him, which tells you what's going on with them, is they're being used for financial gain in some way. Do you want to talk about how you came to write this story and what it's about?
Yeah, I'd love to. Actually, that, and there's one other story that's not online in that form, but that story was created for a comics anthology that my friends put together and invited me. I actually did the cover for this too. It's called Speculative Relationships. Okay. And what it is a science fiction romance comics anthology. Huh. So romance through the lens of science fiction. Huh. And this was my take on it. On a relationship that can't really have romance in it, but, I mean, does that make it invalid? As a thing, you've read the story. I don't know how you took it. But like I said, so, you know, I grew up with stories like The Brave Little Toaster. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in Bangkok in Asia. So robots were just like part of my childhood. A lot of my favorite shows. Transformers is a huge one. And like Macross and Gundam, all that good stuff. So I really wanted to explore the idea of an artificial relationship that nonetheless I think feels intimate. So yeah, it's about these little, like, basically utility droids. And the story starts with the planning from inception, from their blueprints, they were created side by side, and then they were manufactured side by side, and they were sold side by side, because one of them is like a big loader labor robot, and the other one is like a small maintenance electronics repair robot, and they just belong together. But like you said, you see the businessman sees dollar signs. The first dollar sign is for purchasing them. Mm-hmm. The second one is for selling them. Mm-hmm. Or selling one of them. That's the story. If you want to see the whole story, maybe I don't know if I want to give away the whole thing.
Right. You're of course. Of course. It's on your website, and you look under sequential, and you'll see the story there. It's black and white, too, which I find interesting. Why the choice of black and white for this story?
Oh, man, because I just think in black and white.
Oh, you do? Okay.
So the book was to be published in just black and white, But to me, that's just my mode of thought is in black and white. Color does not come naturally to me. I've been really working on it, so I'm proud now that most of the art on my website is in color. Mm-hmm. But actually, a few years ago, that really wasn't the case.
Interesting. And Why is that? Was that just a way that you grew up? You were exposed to black and white? Because, you know, there's a lot of people who think black and white is the best way to illustrate a story. And, of course, we just went through the Christmas season where, of course, you get to see It's a Wonderful Life. And NBC shows it in the original black and white rather than the colorized version. And there's a lot of people who despise the colorized version because black and white, you're able to do things with the gradations of color from black to white. And you do a lot of that. You do a lot of shading and shadowing in there. That's really kind of interesting. I really like the way that you did that. And so I have to say, I'm just fascinated. What was it that drew you to black and white originally?
All my favorite artists are primarily black and white artists. It's funny because my greatest influence has always been comics, and yet I work primarily as a single image illustrator. I'm working on trying to push out of that a little bit and work in full sequential stories going forward, but that's another thing entirely. But yeah, my greatest influences have always been black and white artists. I remember the moment I found Hellboy. Mm-hmm. I picked up a Mike Mignola book, and granted, those aren't actually in black and white, but they might as well be. I think light is the greatest designer, basically. And like you said, when you work in black and white, people equate simple with easy, but actually simple but well executed is the hardest thing. It's elegant. And black and white is less moving parts artistically. But because you don't have color to crutch on, you really have to work on what you have left, because color evokes emotion so well. If you take it out, you have to rely on light and composition to really get across your emotional impact. Mm-hmm. And color is amazing. I live in the Bay Area, so Pixar is right here. But funnily enough, I went to visit the Pixar Museum exhibition that had finally come back to the Bay Area as its last stop before it was done. And this was a traveling art exhibition of Pixar's art. And they've got these things called color scripts. Mm-hmm. And it's the entire movie laid out in storyboard with just color, like abstractly. It's just the color. Mm-hmm. And when you look at it, and they're just designed to strip everything out and make sure that the movie is telling its story with color purely. Mm-hmm. And I looked at those and I was like, my God, I am completely robbing myself of another storytelling tool. Mm-hmm. And mostly because, not because I had anything against color, but because I was so scared by color. Wow. And really that moment this was like probably like 4 or 5 years ago. Mm. That moment of seeing those color scripts really made me realize, like, I'm handicapping myself. Of course, at this point, I also don't regret focusing on black and white, because that part of me is so much stronger now. And as the foundation, even when you work in color, you're working in values, because values being like light and dark. Like, colors carry their own light and dark, too. You can call that blue, but is it a dark blue or is it a light blue? Or if you squint your eyes, that red actually turns into a middle tone. Mm-hmm. So it always comes back down to shade and tone and lighting. Mm-hmm. But yeah, adding color on top of everything else I've been working so hard on, I think, has been really rewarding. And one of the more rewarding personal pursuits in my art the last few years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say, we're going to get to that in a second here. I want to talk about your other story before I get onto the illustration stuff, is that your illustrations are just gorgeous. There's one of a tiger that particularly leaps out at me and stuff like that. So I want to talk about that in a couple minutes. But let's talk, before we leave this, let's talk about the other story. You said you had another sequential story. Do you want to describe it a little bit? Because you said it's not available on the website. What is it?
I call it an anxiety story. So actually, it's called Reflections, and it was in the second volume of Speculative Relationships, both of which we kickstarted. Mm-hmm. And it is, so I had this whole other story planned, and I'm extraordinarily slow when I work. I put a lot of planning and way too much thought into everything, and I'm already slow with single images. So that's why comics and sequential work just terrify me so much, because that little tiny little, like, what, how many pages, 6-page story made to be together took me months to do, because I would just overthink it just so hard. Each panel, you know, was its own illustration, and I'm really trying to let that stuff flow a little bit better. Anyways, my point being, I had this whole other story planned, and I just panicked on it and couldn't, it was too ambitious for what I wanted to do with the time I had. So I made a different story called Reflections, and it's a single panel per page story about this female astronaut being stuck in a white limbo alone. And I don't know where the story came from, to be completely honest. It just came to me one day. But basically, she turns around and has this feeling that someone can see her, and she puts her hands up against the page and looks out, and she's looking at you, the viewer, basically.
Kind of a Grant Morrison thing.
So it's almost like you're looking at her through a plane of glass, like one of those police station one-way mirrors, you know, like interrogation room mirrors. She's looking out through that, and she can feel that someone's on the other side. And so she starts trying to talk to them, but she finds out that when she runs her finger across the glass that separates the viewer from the page, that's when a thing is reflected on the other side of her drawing, tracing across that. But she thinks it's just a reflection at first, but actually there are small variations in the tracing. And she figures out that she's actually communicating with something.
Very cool.
A really weird pick. It's a really weird story. It's a really weird comic. I like it because it's weird, but I'm not entirely sure it's well done enough. So that's why I haven't put it online yet. I'm not sure if it's... It's kind of a weird thought putting it out there. I know it's out there in a book, you know, but that's a different thing because it's in context with the other stories in this book, too.
But do you ever read Grant Morrison's Animal Man?
No, it's on the list. But
if you ever get a chance, because there's one point at which, and now it's been like a couple of decades since that came out, so I don't think I'm spoiling too much, but there's a point at which Buddy Baker turns around and looks, and he looks off the page at us. He sees us, the readers, and he says, "I can see you. I can see you out there." And I remember this shiver going down my spine when I read that. And you're thing talking about that, because I don't think people utilize that whole concept right as often as they could. And I just was like, and there's actually the conclusion of the story in probably the last book Grant Morrison writes, he's actually talking to Animal Man. They're walking through, and he's talking to Animal Man about comics and about life and all this kind of stuff. And all of a sudden he turns to Animal Man and says, "Well, you know, the readers are going to start getting bored, so we better have somebody come up here try to kill you." And out comes this thing comes out trying to kill him. He said, "Well, you don't have to do that." No, he's fighting while Grant Morrison's walking along beside him talking. And, you know, your description of that makes me think of that story. You know, that's kind of a neat thing. I don't think we deal with the what they call the breakdown of the third wall, the fourth wall, enough, because there's plenty of really interesting things that can be done with that. I'd like to see that. Sometime I have to try to locate that, because it sounds like an interesting little story.
Yeah, I'll definitely put it up at some point, I think, if not on my website itself, because the website's kind of like the portfolio, and sometimes I don't put my more like experimental weird things up on there, just because the portfolio, you know, is supposed to be like your best of the best, that's like you seducing clients. But I'll probably put it up on my blog or something at some point soon.
I'd like to see that. Sounds a really interesting thing to. Now, you have an art book out of your stuff, and I've heard you describe it. It's a display of your journey to becoming a professional artist. Do you want to talk about Fathoms a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I kickstarted it earlier this year. After much hand-wringing and hemming and hawing, I decided to just kind of put it all out there and just go for it. And yeah, it was my first Kickstarter experience, and it went so much better than I could have hoped for.
Okay, that's good.
And people really came out and really supported it, which was very overwhelming and very touching and just amazing. But yeah, the book itself is 6 years worth of work. It's basically 2009 till now, mm-hmm. to 2016. And the putting together of the book is somewhat informed by my experience at Comic Cons. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing I do a lot of. That's actually my bread and butter potatoes, mm-hmm. meat and potatoes, is that I do a lot of comic conventions and sell art and prints and now books directly to people, to potential new fans, or, you know, I've just made my living, actually a significant part of my living off of doing that. Anyways, putting together the book was informed by that experience, because the same questions would come up a lot. You know, what inspires you? How long have you been doing this for? What medium do you use and stuff? So I put together the book with that in mind, and even the title Fathoms A, I do a lot of very nautical or marine based art, you know, a lot of divers, deep sea diver. Mm-hmm. is what I'm best known for. So Fathoms, the title, implies depth, because a fathom is a unit to measure depth. It's actually your wingspan, about 6 feet. Mm-hmm. And then to fathom is also to understand. Mm-hmm. So I came up with this. Actually, I'm pretty proud of the title, I gotta say. But that it implies the themes of my art, but also like implies getting to better understand me and my art. Mm-hmm. So as I put the book together, I tried to make sure that imparts some knowledge. I hope it imparts some knowledge of who I am and why I make work and where the work comes from in terms of my personal experience or what have you, what I'm trying to say with the work. Mm-hmm. And it has a process section in the back, so it shows how I make the work. I actually paint in Sumi ink wash, mm-hmm. which is another thing that tends to surprise people a lot.
Mm-hmm. Now talk about the book. How many pages are in the book?
It's 80 pages.
Okay.
80 pages total with, I forget how many pieces of art are actually in there. It's like 70 pieces of art plus a bunch of pages of process. So I walk through the creation of that tiger piece you mentioned earlier.
Right.
I walk through the creation of it from scribble to finished painting. And show other process sketches and stuff in there too, and actually have a little page about the materials I use, the kind of ink I use, and brushes and paper and such.
So are you're a physical ink and paper type guy as opposed to, say, a computer person?
Yeah, very much so. I went to school in 2003, 2007. So making paintings, making work on the computer was definitely being done. It's kind of amazing how things have changed in like 5 years, because it was really kind of a mysterious thing back then. Mm-hmm. Like you had to really go and find the right people who painted digitally. And now it's like actually the default, and doing it physically, doing it traditionally is rare. And people are surprised when I say that I do that. Mm-hmm. It's actually what kept me from color for a while, because coloring my black and white ink work was difficult traditionally. I used to like put colored inks and watercolors over it, but that kind of makes it muddy sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I had to learn to color my stuff digitally, and that was a little bit of a hurdle for me for a while.
I want to point out to people, if you go to your website, there's a store on there where you can buy this book. There's a $35 edition and a $25 edition. Is the $25 a trade versus a hardcover?
Yes. Yeah. Same content. But hardcover is hardcover, and the hardcover is actually a limited edition of 500 books.
Hmm, very cool. Because there's a lot of really interesting things. Now, I have to ask you, of course, because you talk about sequential art being a little more difficult to you. And yet, when I look at your individual pieces, each individual piece kind of tells a very short story to it, seems to me. You know, you've got the picture of the person in the deep sea suit, and he takes off the helmet and looks like water or something coming out of his helmet. That's kind of telling a story, just like the tiger does. The tiger, you kind of imagine what it is. He's looking off panel, and, you know, angry at something. So we get a sense that there's a story there, and our imagination kind of fills in those things. It's like when you leave off a part of a circle, the mind automatically draws that part of the circle we can't see. So just like with your art, we get to see, even if it's a shorter story, we still get a story involved as far as that goes. It's just kind of fascinating to me. I could see you doing sequential art real easily because of your artwork, because every little story that you tell is really interesting, and I could see you telling longer stories than just a picture as well.
Absolutely. I'm flattered that you pick up on that, because storytelling is just the utmost for me. If there isn't a story to tell, there's not much interest in it for me. Mm-hmm. So each and every piece has to have a core, some kind of emotional narrative moment that you can latch yourself to, that you can think about and get lost in for a second. Mm-hmm. Like, even if I'm getting commissioned to draw a Batman piece at a con, a sketch, it can't just be Batman standing there. There's got to be a moment. I just did a Batman commission, actually, for one of my Kickstarter backers. And it took me forever to think of it, because I'm like, I like Batman, and my Batman is the animated Batman from the 90s. That's my Batman. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to think of a narrative thing worth saying in art about Batman that isn't just, look how cool he is standing there in the Gotham darkness. Mm-hmm. So I came up with this weird piece of Batman in like almost a nightmare, where he's standing on all these broken bones, mm-hmm. and behind is like a giant skull shattering. Because mm-hmm. the question that came up in my head was, after a lifetime of literally cracking skulls, what does that leave mm-hmm. on a person? How does that affect someone? And this question just came to me. I was like, I wonder if Batman hears the sound of cracking bones in his sleep. All right, that's it. I'll do that.
Because I see an illustration of it on Facebook. You can see a picture of that particular graphic, which I like. You're right. It just brings out something. You have to wonder, what are Batman's dreams or nightmares like?
Right. I mean, he can't have nightmares about his parents every night. He's got to worry about other things. Mm-hmm. And I would like to think that Bruce Wayne is just still a person, and sometimes the weight of the amount of violence he's brought upon people, deserving of it or not, would sometimes occasionally occur to him.
Mm-hmm. I got to talk about another piece that I saw on Facebook that I really liked. You called it a fun, small commission, and it's the Death Star versus, and I always mispronounce this name, it's Cthulhu?
Cthulhu?
Cthulhu. That's it. I always pronounce that wrong.
It's okay. There's no wrong way to say it, because as Lovecraft himself says, it's not a word meant for the human tongue.
Well, it's just really cool.
I think the consensus is that it's Cthulhu. Okay, okay. But you're supposed to like cough it out. It's Cthulhu. I read a lot about Lovecraft when I was in high school.
Well, it's a great picture of Cthulhu. I'll probably just butcher it again, with taking hold of the Death Star. And it's such an interesting picture, because in my imagination, I can't think of that kind of thing. It just doesn't come naturally. So when I could see it, I was like, that is so fascinating. Such an interesting thing. Now, did the person want you to do that? Did you come up with the concept for that? How did you do that?
He specifically said, oh, how about Cthulhu attacking the Death Star? And I was like, all right, yeah, I can do that. I can do something with it.
It's really cool, I have to say. If you get a chance, look on Facebook. It posted on your page on December 7th. So in case somebody wants to go and find, it's really good.
If you go on my website, mm-hmm. and hit the blog button, mm-hmm. it'll be on there as well. That's probably like a easier way than hunting me down on Facebook, which you're welcome to do. There's a link to Facebook on my website. But yeah, go to my website and hit blog, and it should be on there as well.
Very cool. Now, I want to go back to something you mentioned. And that is, you're going to conventions, and that's another thing I saw. And of course, I tend to be a Facebook guy, so I tend to look through Facebook, and I noticed a whole bunch of pictures of you at conventions, including you're one of the very fortunate people who gets to have a table at Emerald City Comic Con, which is
not this year, not this coming year. Though. I did not get the table this year. I have the past 2 years,
okay,
but yeah, for whatever reason, I didn't get it this year, but. To my joy, actually, a lot of people I know who have never gotten a table at Emerald City are getting a table this year. Oh, so I'd like to think that they're actually making a concerted effort to rotate through people a little bit more and give everyone a chance.
Okay, because there's a lot of people I know who would love to get in there. But yeah, they year after year, they apply and apply and apply and never get in. So I was thinking how fortunate you've been to be able to get in there and have a table there to be able to sell some of your good stuff. So that's good. What conventions do you prefer to go to? Are there, like, if, say, somebody's listening and they want to come and get a piece of art from you personally, which conventions are you almost always going to go to? Like, say, 2017, this is the beginning of 2017. What conventions are you planning to attend this year?
Well, I'm confirmed for C2E2 in Chicago, for Dragon Con in Atlanta.
Oh, boy.
Those are my two confirmations. Otherwise, I try to do as many of the awesome ones as possible. But let's see. You can hopefully find me in New York at a really small indie one called Mocha Fest, which is the Museum of Comic and Cartoon Art Festival.
Cool.
Yeah, Chicago. I'm looking at my list now. Ooh, I am confirmed for San Diego Comic-Con for the first.
I'll have to say hi to you because I'm going to be there.
Oh, cool. I won't be at Artist Alley. I have an exhibitor table.
Okay.
So you'll find me. You'll find me in the exhibitor section. Cool. I think, like, up towards the back of the hall, like, more towards the video games than the Artist Alley, if that makes sense. If you can see, I can see the map in my head. Yeah.
Is that where you like to be? Is it? Do you prefer to be near where the gaming is?
No, not particularly. This is my, well, this is my first official time at San Diego. I've done it before. I've exhibited once, but I piggybacked on someone else's booth. And that booth was straight up in the merchandise exhibition section.
Okay.
And that wasn't super great just because I don't feel like people were looking for art. But yeah, this is my first time full on doing it, so I don't really know how it's going to go. I'm a little bit nervous just because it's quite the investment.
Oh, yeah.
And you're just never sure what the return will be like on a show until you do it.
But the possibilities are amazing when it comes to San
Diego.
Oh,
absolutely. Absolutely.
You can meet people. You talked about meeting an IDW guy who just happened to walk by. There are so many things going on. People have, like, they'll sell a comic and they'll get optioned for a movie or a TV show. And
yeah, I know some of those people personally.
Oh, wow, how cool that is.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm not under any illusion that anything's going to happen, but, you know, it's nice to be in the pond fishing with everybody else, you know?
Yeah, that's cool. Because one of the things about San Diego that always gets me is you go around and downtown San Diego basically gets taken over by the comics folks. And what happens is you if you're not in a costume, are actually the oddball type person. You'll have people walking around in costumes all the whole time San Diego's going on. And I have to say, I was there one time before, and by the end of the fourth or fifth day, I was going like, man, I don't know if I want to be around costumes all the time like this. You know, you got a guy dressed up like the Silver Surfer, and he's painted all over. He's got underwear on, painted silver, and I was kind of like, I don't know. And some of the people wearing Superman really should not have been wearing Superman, to be frank.
You know, I've always liked comic conventions because they feel fairly safe, you know, in terms of, like, whatever you're into, you can do it, and no one will really ridicule you for it. So if you are that guy who wants to dress up like a big hairy Sailor Moon, then you should be, and I've seen this, I've seen several of these guys, and I'm every time I see that, I just smile and I say, good for you. Like, I'm so happy that you are comfortable doing something. I mean, unless you lost the bet, I guess, like, I assume that you're doing it because you want to do it. So I'm just generally fairly happy for people to do whatever they want as long as it's not hurting anyone else.
I have to tell you, I was at Baltimore Comic Con, and we were there in the DC people all, and George Perez was up on the in the panel. And there was, of course, other artists and stuff. There came in this guy, and he was so hairy you couldn't see his skin, but he's in a Wonder Woman outfit.
Yeah.
And George Perez actually turns and looks to him and said, you know, you're the hairiest Wonder Woman I've ever seen, he goes. That was kind of funny.
That man's a hero. That man's a hero to us all.
Well, you know, the truth of it is this gives you a chance to be yourself. You can wear your PJs if you want to go there to these conventions and stuff. And I see a lot of people wearing their superhero pajamas walking around.
Absolutely. And I think it's great that these events are there for people to feel comfortable at.
Mm-hmm. You don't dress up as anybody there, do you? Or are you?
Oh God, no! I would die of embarrassment. I don't even dress up for Halloween. If I do, I have to cover my face. Okay. The last time I did it, actually, I did a few years ago. I dressed up as an anglerfish.
Oh.
And I built this helmet, anglerfish helmet, out of a bicycle helmet, and it was awesome. I gotta say. But I need to cover my face, or else I die of embarrassment.
So if we see somebody with their face covered, it might be you.
It might be me.
Okay, that'll be good. So you're doing good stuff. Why don't you tell us about, because 2017, we're just getting started. You talked about a couple of conventions you're going to go to. What other things do you have in store for us in 2017?
Oh, I'm figuring that out for myself right now, too. Okay. This was a busy year. This was the best year I've ever had in terms of, you know, making a living doing this.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Some of that was from the Kickstarter, for sure. Mm-hmm. Some of that was from getting some cool freelance. And then a bunch of that was actually from conventions. Like, I got into New York Comic Con for the first time.
Oh, boy.
This last year, after applying for, like, 5 years.
Oh, wow.
They finally – I feel like that's maybe partially why they didn't give me Emerald City this year, too, because it was run by the same showrunner as Repop.
Okay.
And they were like, yeah, we gave you New York this year, so – I understand, again, there's so many people out there now. I'm constantly aware that this whole convention thing may be speeding towards a saturation point. And so, you know, I'm ready for it to stop being so reliable. But until then, it's been really great. I kind of owe everything to conventions, honestly.
Wow.
But otherwise, my actual, like, career is, a lot of my opportunities have come from doing conventions.
Oh, cool. Very cool. What about social media and stuff? Like, you've mentioned you're out on social media. Do you get commissions through social media as well?
A little bit. I can't say that I've managed to work social media in a way that has... Well, okay, that's not true, because the Kickstarter's momentum came from social media. Mm-hmm. My own efforts, and then through that, the efforts of my community and stuff of spreading the word. It was pretty amazing. So in that way, yeah, social media has been absolutely indispensable. It's also been indispensable in that just feeling like you're part of a community. Like, my artistic family on social media is amazing, and we get to see each other as a group a few times a year, or here and there, different conventions and stuff.
Cool.
And the face-to-face is amazing, but it's nice to just be able to see someone and already know what's going on.
That's good. That's great. So, of course, I got to ask, if you could draw any character, which character would you like to do, like, a cover of or a pinup of? You've done Batman. You've got a lot of seafaring things. Aquaman? What kind of character would you, if somebody said to you, go wild and do whatever you want and I'll pay for it, what would you do?
Oh, all right. If we're talking about deep, dark nerd things,
okay.
You know what it's going to be? It's going to be Warhammer 40K stuff.
Oh, wow.
I don't know how much you know about that stuff, you know.
Some, yeah.
Warhammer 40,000 Space Marines with shoulder pads the size of buses and stuff. I want to say that a lot of that stuff is foundational to my art as well. Even painting those little pewter figures. Mm-hmm. In my childhood/teen years, that's where my art hand comes from. That's where my brush control comes from, you know, doing that stuff. And I've actually, like, a little, like, let's just say it right now, over this holiday break, I've been actually pawing through some of my old Warhammer art books and some of the rule books and stuff, and the art in there that I remember being inspired by is still hell of good. It's still really, like, I've been fortunate enough as my career has gone on to meet a bunch of these guys in person and be able to, like, fawn in person over their work.
Mm-hmm.
So this stuff is still great. A lot of it's black and white. A lot of it actually is ink, too. And that was a weird realization. I was like, oh, my God, it's not just the subject matter. It's actually a lot of the execution in here, too. Mm-hmm. I just didn't realize it. Like, there's, like, this chaotic – some of it, the best of it, for me, has this, like, kind of messy chaoticness to it that, like, comes from ink and gouache. And I'm like, wow, this stuff is still great. Mm-hmm. And it's cool. Like, sometimes you go back to your childhood – or anything that you grew up loving, and sometimes you go back to it as an adult, and it maybe doesn't really hold up anymore.
Mm-hmm.
but it's really nice to look at art that I thought was cool when I was younger and look at it now as a working professional and be like, nah, this is still really cool. This is still good art.
I hope sometime in the future somebody will come and say, you know, there was this really great art that I saw from Michael Mann Immovable, and it still holds up after all this time. This is great stuff.
I hope so, too. I hope so, too. Hope I don't get to this point where people look at my work and go, man, I miss 2015, 2016 Michael, because I don't like his work anymore.
Oh, no.
I worry about that, too, sometimes.
Oh, why? Because, you know,
sometimes I look at artists and I go, man, I wish you were still making work that looks like the stuff you're making in 2008 or whatever.
But see, your stuff, it feels like it's evolving and it's growing, and the amount of expression and detail in it is just amazing to me. I don't see you slowing down with that. I think you're going to get even better at that as time goes along.
I really hope so. I really hope so. I do struggle a lot, I have to be honest, with where to take it, how to continuously push it. But that's true of every single artist out there anyways.
I think you're going to continue to get better and better, and I think it's going to be more fun. I think as time goes along, I think people will more and more discover your stuff and really enjoy it, because it's very dynamic and it's very fascinating. It's hard to take your eyes off of, honestly. So I just think it's wonderful stuff, and I hope 2017 is even better than 2016 for you, because I think
you
deserve it, because it's really wonderful stuff you're making.
Thank you. I hope so, too.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast, so you can keep reading your comics.
That's it for the first episode of 2017. We're off to a great start, so I'll be back next week when I'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.